Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 22. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting and the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader blog and podcast. And my podcasting partner, as usual, is Pam Fox Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How are you today?
Excellent, Peter. How are you?
I'm excellent. Fall's creeping up on us here. It's been pretty chilly the last few days. Otherwise, no complaints. How about you? How's the weather out there?
Well, you know how I usually say it is sunny in Sunnyvale, but it is most definitely not. Today was the first day of our first fall storm, and it is already the worst October storm in 45 years. And I am just watching from my office the trees sway and the petals form, and I think it's beautiful. I was so excited when I heard there was going to be a storm. It's just like brushing away summer, and it's ushered in fall.
It sounds like a typical New England day to me. Anyway, how did your type webinar go last week?
Oh, thank you. It was about blind spots, and it was an absolute blast to do. So I'm used to doing, in addition to real live, presentations, I'm used to doing calls where I can hear people, at least if they choose to unmute, and where the questions come in to me live from their voices. This was a more button-down webinar format, and so that aspect of it was new to me, and actually I found it was fine. I could imagine the people that were actually there, and then the questions got fed through a moderator, so I was able to answer actual questions during the webinar. But it was a lot of fun, and if people missed it and they're interested, at some point that will be available as a DVD for purchase, so I can, let people know when that's out. But we're looking forward to doing more of these. It's a great way for type practitioners to get continuing education and CEUs without having to get on an airplane. So it turned out to be a good format.
So let's talk about some leadership news. I just have one item that jumped out at me this week. We had an item the week before that we talked about President Obama and the Olympics, and we don't want this to be all President Obama all the time podcast, but he's the subject again of our leadership item this week, our news item this week, and that is the Nobel Peace Prize. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, and I don't know about you, but it just struck me as a rather strange selection 2 weeks after, I think he had to be nominated 2 weeks after he became president. So it's obviously something based more on promise and maybe even on the just change. I mean, that's what he ran on, and hope and change, and that's what the promise that he's brought, he's bringing to people. But you have any thoughts on maybe what it does to the Nobel Peace Prize? Does it marginalize it to some degree? It just seems a rather strange selection at this point, since he hasn't really had an opportunity to accomplish that much as a leader.
Well, it struck me as strange as well. And I have to say, as I was glancing through my Twitter feed in the morning, I thought it was like a tweet from The Onion or something. I really didn't think that it was possibly true that Obama in his first year as president had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's such an awkward position as a leader, and you've probably been in those situations too, where you get some sort of an honor and people, typically mean well by it. There's thoughts here as to whether folks are attempting to persuade him to act in some way or another, but let's just say, people mean well by it, but you think it's just wholly undeserved. And so, some people are calling for him to reject it, and he's choosing a different path, which is what I often think is the best thing leaders can do, is to say thank you on behalf of a broader group, to accept it on behalf of, the people around the country who are really working towards change, and on behalf of the hard work that we have yet to do, all of that. But boy, is that a tough situation to be in.
Yeah, fascinating. Michael Watkins had a post on the Harvard Business Blogs about basically the promise of what happens when somebody gets an honor based on future promise and the challenges involved there. So it's interesting. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. So don't want to belabor that point, but anyway, I thought it was worth mentioning. Our website of the week this week is bridgestar.org. Are you familiar with that, Pam?
I am. It's a project of Bridgespan, and I think you and I both had some good relationships with that organization.
Yeah.
It was founded by Tom Tierney, who was head of the San Francisco office of Bain & Company when I started 22 years ago there. And he then became head of Bain & Company and then left about 10 years ago to go start Bridgespan, a consulting group really focused on nonprofits. And I have to say, one of the things that I've been so struck about as a Bain alum is that although it's hard to find a more intensely capitalistic focused company, you know, I remember the sign up in one of the partners' offices that said, "We have a sane, mature attitude towards our competitors. We want them dead." There is a deep, deep core of public service running through many Bain current employees and alums. And I have been very impressed with what Tom Tierney has built in this organization, in Bridgespan.
From their website, this is what it says there, Bridgestar, and the URL for that is www.bridgestar.org, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes. An initiative of the Bridgespan Group provides nonprofit management, job content, and tools designed to help nonprofit organizations build strong leadership teams and individuals pursue career paths as nonprofit leaders. So, you know, why I chose it, it's just an amazing resource for nonprofit leaders and for people that might be contemplating making a transition from another sector, the private sector or the government sector, into a nonprofit leadership job, because we hear so often about the crisis of that is faced by leadership positions in the nonprofit world. There's great articles here, super resources for leaders. Whether you're a paid leader as an executive director, or they spend a lot of time on the website too talking about chief operating officers, or if you're a board member, there's a lot of great board resources there as well. So you can, as an individual, go in there and find job postings. You can also go in there and find opportunities to serve on boards. And when I was an executive director of a nonprofit, I did actually use it and was successfully used it to recruit some board members who never otherwise would have found us. So I think it's a fantastic tool. They have a monthly newsletter that I continue to subscribe to, and it's called Leadership Matters, that has some great information in it each month. And this month, I think there's an article about really kind of taking control of your own leadership development as a nonprofit leader, because budgets are so constrained, and spending on those types of issues, as we'll talk about in your research report, has been an area that has been subject to neglect in the nonprofit world, frankly. So it's a great resource. The Bridgespan website as well has some great things there that aren't just duplicates of what appears on Bridgestar. So I highly encourage people to, if you're in the nonprofit world or you're thinking of going to nonprofit world, check this website out, because it's got tons and tons of stuff that will be useful to you. So let's jump into your research report of the week, because there's a tie-in to the Bridgestar.
Yeah, coincidentally, the article that I selected was written by two people from Bridgestar, Bridgespan, Ann Coggins Gregory and Don Howard, and it appeared in the latest issue of the Stanford Social Innovation Review. And they have a few of the articles from that publication are available for free online. This is one of them, and I know we'll include a link in the show notes. It's called The Nonprofit Starvation Cycle. And you and I have both been executive directors of nonprofits and served on boards, and we know that people pay a great deal of attention to percentage of overhead, and we also know that much of that attention is coming from a place of shallow rather than deep understanding. And what I like about this article is that in one short article, it summarizes a lot of recent research, including their own, and it lays out so clearly how we get in the situation of nonprofits chronically underfunding critical infrastructure. And the way they say the cycle goes, the first step is funders have unrealistic expectations about how much it costs to run a nonprofit. And then they feel, nonprofits feel the pressure to conform to those unrealistic expectations. So third step, they spend too little on overhead and they underreport their expenditures, calling things direct when they're really indirect. And that leads to funders and everybody else having unrealistic ratios and then holding them to those unrealistic ratios. And it just gets worse and worse. And of course, at a time right now where organizations are so strapped, it's even more difficult to find money for what the so-called overhead. And if you're new to the nonprofit world, that means really everything except for direct service delivery. So the leadership of the organization, your computer system, time and money spent recruiting, spent on training and learning and development, all the things that other sectors know are absolutely critical to getting the value out of your investment in program, nonprofits wind up being just hideously starved for. And what they say is, funders, it's got to stop with you. So you have to stop putting this kind of unrealistic pressure. Yes, look at the indirect expenses and say, are these well spent? But your question might be, are you investing sufficiently in infrastructure? Do you need to be investing more and in what, rather than how can we get down that percentage of overhead? And there's wonderful studies that are cited in the article. I really encourage anyone who's interested in nonprofits or thinking about serving on a board to go ahead and read this article. It's a good one.
Yeah, it definitely is. And to maybe even focus it a little bit more on leadership, they do definitely recommend that the first step would have to be taken or should be taken by funders. But, you know, I think it bears the question that we talk about this all the time. Leadership is a very difficult thing. That's why people don't exercise it as often as they probably should. And our weekly leader this week will talk a little bit about that. But if you're an executive director in a nonprofit, you really find yourself oftentimes caught in a challenging situation because, you know, you're really beholden to your funder. So when somebody has that authority over you because they control the purse strings, there's power there. And it's very difficult sometimes to confront or have those difficult conversations or present the numbers just the way they should be to break this cycle. And the article does call for this as well, but I also think that the nonprofit leaders, the executive directors, really have to exercise leadership, and it might be dangerous to do so, but I think people have to step up more often and address these concerns. I know it happens. I know people do it. The challenge is, how do you communicate it without sounding like you're, you know, sour grapes, or you're complaining about a situation that can't be changed, because it has to be changed, and it can be changed, I think, if it's communicated in the right way. So this is, I think, one of the biggest challenges nonprofit leaders have, especially those that are not all that well-funded and find themselves in this kind of doom loop. They're constantly trying to find resources just to keep things going and not reinvesting in the organization itself or in the people that run the organization. So it's a great article, and I hope funders obviously take that first step, but I think it's going to require also nonprofit leaders to kind of step forward into that dangerous territory of leadership, which we talk about all the time. That segues us into our weekly leader this week. I had the great fortune of meeting Ed O'Malley, who is the CEO of Kansas Leadership Center, at a program at the Harvard Kennedy School called the Art and Practice of Leadership Development, which was run by Marty Linsky, one of our previous weekly leaders. So let's hear from Ed about civic leadership.
Show me your other side. whisper to me all that you see. Don't be afraid, don't ever hesitate, and take me through a taste of what's new. I'll let you lead the way. Can you take me where I've wanted to be? Will you take a chance and show it to me? Take me back, take me where I need to be.
This week's weekly leader is Ed O'Malley, who is the president and CEO of the Kansas Leadership Center. Hi, Ed. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you.
It'd be really helpful for our listeners if you could tell them who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, as you said, my name is Ed O'Malley. I'm the president of the Kansas Leadership Center. We are a new organization founded just about 2.5 years ago. And our charge is to foster civic leadership for healthier Kansas communities. And we were established with a rather significant multi-year, multi-million-dollar grant from a local philanthropy here in Kansas.
Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Our core funder is the Kansas Health Foundation. And the Health Foundation has been around for over 25 years now. Their mission is to improve the health of all Kansans. And during that time, during the last 25 years, what they have discovered is that the quality of civic leadership, the quality of the individuals who are engaging to make the community a healthier place, the quality of civic leadership is a primary determinant of whether communities will indeed become healthier. So while they still invest a lot of their resources in more traditional health-oriented projects, they have carved out a 10-year, $30 million grant to create the Kansas Leadership Center and have charged us with specifically focusing on increasing the civic leadership capacity of the state. So we are connected to them, but we are a separate organization with our own board of directors and our own unique purpose. But they see us very clearly fitting in a broader approach at improving the health of all Kansans.
Sounds pretty unique. Are there other organizations that have been set up like yours to have similar missions?
You know, Peter, I wish I could say yes, because when I was hired to do this, I came down, I moved my family here to Wichita, Kansas, from the Kansas City area, and I sat down in a temporary office that first day, and I thought to myself, well, surely I can find something we can model this after. And what I found is that there's nothing, to our knowledge, there's nothing quite like this anywhere in the nation. And what we mean by that, there's nothing that has a statewide scope that also has a focus squarely on this idea of civic leadership, or leadership for the common good is another way we talk about it sometimes. And also nothing that has a resource base this significant, something like a $30 million grant, something large enough to allow itself to be created any which way it deems most appropriate. So, you know, the scope, the focus, and the resource base is really unique, which is a bit daunting because it's always nice to have something to model after, but it's also tremendously exciting because we're really getting to do some interesting work at a scale that we believe can truly affect the state of Kansas.
What'd you do before this?
My background is primarily in government and politics. So I actually resigned my seat in the Kansas legislature. I was a member of the Kansas House of Representatives before I accepted this position. And prior to that, I worked as an aide to Governor Bill Graves, one of our former governors here in Kansas. So my background is in the legislative arena primarily, which in many ways gave me a kind of a in the ring, in the arena view of not only good acts of civic leadership, but pathetic acts of civic leadership. So I've seen both sides, which is helpful for this position.
You're the first president of the organization, right?
That's right. That's right.
So what was that process like when, you know, here's a new organization with this really exciting mission? It must have been a pretty attractive job, and you're a pretty young guy, and to be a candidate for this must have been pretty exciting. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, it was very interesting. I was actually in the middle of a re-election to my seat in the legislature, and I got a call one day from an executive recruiting firm and mentioning this job and if I had an interest in talking with them about it. And my first response was no, that I was busy trying to get reelected, which is an all-consuming activity, as you might imagine, and I was trying to eliminate all distractions. I also have a young family, and they were even younger then. I had two 2-year-olds at the time. And so things were quite hectic, and I told them, you know, thanks, but no thanks. But as they kept talking, and they actually called back a few days later, it began to sound more and more intriguing. And so it was a lengthy process that lasted about 6 months of interviews, and I imagine the search committee, you know, winnowing down to a final group and so on and so forth. But during that process, I went from being not interested at all to realizing that it's a really amazing opportunity to affect the state of Kansas, the state I love, my native state, to affect the state of Kansas in ways that I've always dreamed of. And I always felt that serving in the legislature was a way to accomplish those dreams. But this seemed like an opportunity to have far more greater impact than I could have as one member of a legislature. So it was a really interesting personal experience for me and for my wife as we contemplated whether this was the right fit for us. And we eventually were offered the job and took the leap.
New CEO, new organization, temporary office, I think you said, probably
right.
Cardboard box sitting somewhere. All of a sudden, first day you're sitting there, what are you thinking? What's going on?
Well, yeah, I remember sitting down and closing the door behind me and just kind of thinking to myself, well, okay, how should we get started? And then my phone rang, and it was my father. And my dad wanted to know if they'd given me the $30 million yet. I think Dad imagined that maybe they would, you know, be a treasure chest full of cash, of unmarked bills or something. But so that was how the day got started. And, you know, from there, my perspective was we just have to be very intentional about this, and we have to make sure we get it right. I remember that very first day I started using language in my own head as well as talking to other people, using language such as, this is a healthy burden. It's healthy because, I mean, wow, I mean, how many leadership organizations would dream of this type of resource at their disposal? But it's also a burden because we've got to get it right. We owe it not only to the state of Kansas, but to all those other people around the state and the nation who are engaged in leadership development who don't have access to this type of resource. So it's been a very healthy burden, and we've used that language from the very beginning to help us all stay very focused and intentional and diligent about creating something pretty special here.
And were you employee number one?
I was.
And
I was.
So you've built a staff. How big is your staff over there?
Our staff right now is made up of about, exactly 9 full-time individuals. We have another about 14 or 15 individuals who are on contract with us. Mm-hmm. So these are people who serve as faculty for our programs or project directors for us. So full and kind of contract part-time staff, we're an organization of about 25 folks now. And while this, the other folks I'll mention here aren't staff, they're an integral part of our organization. We have a 9-member board of directors. We have an advisory group that helps us. We have an evaluation team that's helping us think through evaluation questions. We have a cadre of people that we call leadership coaches that work with our participants. And you add up all those people together, the staff, the board, the faculty, the project directors, the leadership coaches, the evaluation team. And we have a team of about, you know, 55 to 60 people now who are guiding this ship, molding it, shaping it, helping influence it, make it their own. So it's fun to go from 1 to, you know, 55 to 60 folks.
Yeah, wow, that's exciting. Do you have a significant personal or professional event or an experience that you think has formed your leadership style, the way you exercise leadership?
I do. I mean, there have been a number of things that have helped contribute to how I think about it. But the one that stands out the most is a situation that occurred while I was in the legislature in 2005. And we had a rather significant legislative crisis at hand related to the funding for public education. Our Supreme Court had suggested, had said, had ruled that our current way of funding schools was unconstitutional. And we were forced as a legislature to come back into a special session of the legislature, which is highly unusual in Kansas. They happen frequently in some other states, but not frequently in Kansas. And we were tasked with solving this constitutional crisis. And it was a fascinating experience for me. I ended up being one of eight individuals, five Republicans, three Democrats, who crafted the legislation that eventually passed and solved the constitutional crisis. And my role during that time, I was very cognizant of what my role was as a member of that group. And I didn't have the exact language to use then that I might have now, but my focus was on the process of keeping those eight people together and then of mobilizing others throughout the legislature to engage with those eight to eventually create a group of people that had the ability to pass this legislation. And so it was an experience that, in a very heated, dramatic situation, a very pressure-packed situation, it was an experience that helped me learn about that from my perspective, exercising leadership is often about tending to the process by which people are wrestling with tough issues. So while I had plenty of content ideas, I had plenty of ideas about how we should fix the school finance formula, I thought of myself as exercising leadership in keeping the people together, keeping the process healthy, creating a strong holding environment, some of the language that, Peter, I know you've used before and I've used before too, creating a strong holding environment for that work to take place. So that was a really pivotal moment for me in my professional and personal life. And most of those discussions and happened around the governor's conference table. And just a few years before, I was on a previous governor's staff, and it was a really fascinating moment for me because when I was on the governor's staff, I knew there were high-level meetings like that took place in that conference room, but I was never a part of them. And so it was a really interesting set of moments for all sorts of different reasons. But it's had a profound effect on me.
How old were you when that took place?
I was I would have been 30 years old.
30 years old. So, and yeah. You're dealing with the people, I'm sure, in that situation where there's probably most of them were older than you.
Well, I was by far the youngest person in the room.
And what was that experience like for you personally and just when you kind of step on the balcony, as we used the term in adaptive leadership, what was that experience like?
Well, it's something that I had become used to, going back to when I began working for Governor Graves, our former governor. I was always the youngest person in the room, and I was always very intentional about trying to understand what that meant for me and my engagement with the group and how others would perceive me. And it became something I thought about frequently because I understood that it would affect the amount of authority I would be given by others in the group. And by that time, by the time of this special session, I think I had developed enough authority or credibility with those other individuals that my age wasn't as much of a factor, although it was still something I was probably thinking about it more often than the rest of the folks. But I think I was probably the youngest person in the room by far. Most folks were 50 and older, and these weren't just any folks. I mean, these were some really experienced, wonderful people in state government, state politics, and the governor, Governor Sebelius, who's now Secretary of Health and Human Services for the Obama administration, she was in those negotiations throughout. So it was a fascinating experience for a 30-year-old guy to go through.
That's kind of intergenerational. How did that experience impact the way you might help young leaders coming along, young people coming along and who are exercising leadership. Is there any, how do you share that experience with them?
That's a great question, Peter, and it's probably worth a lot of thought. My initial reaction to it is, I worked really hard to exist in their way of thinking rather than try to push my way of thinking on them. So, it's older generations just think differently, and in a lot of ways, it's really helpful. It's a little slower pace, for example.
Sure.
And I allowed myself just to participate in that and not try to modify it too much. But I'll tell you, there was a time that it was really really fun to see happen. Now this was back in 2005, so. Not everybody back then is using text messaging and things like that. But there were a lot of us in the legislature who did use text messaging, and there was this moment during this process where we have the legislation drafted and we believe that we are on the verge of having the votes to get passed. And we're in the governor's office and with the eight individuals and the governor and the governor's staff. And there were about two or three of her staff members and two or three of the legislators who were texting other legislators out throughout the Capitol trying to count votes. And counting votes, as you might imagine, in the legislative arena is a very critical task and a hard skill. It's a hard skill to count votes. It seems like it should be easy, but it's difficult. Hmm. And I think this may have been the first time, at least in Kansas, that text messaging or digital technology was used to count votes to determine whether or not we should bring the vote to the floor or not. And it was fun. We were having people in that conference room, yell out, okay, McKinney, he's a yes, he's a yes. I just got his text message. And it was later that night that we knew we had the votes and we made it happen.
Amazing.
So it was fun to kind of bring some of that technology typically associated with younger generations into the process eventually.
Let me come at that question another way too. You're going to get older. And
yeah.
You are getting older. We're all getting older, right? And as we get older, I'm just wondering how the early youthful experiences will impact the way you perceive and develop young people as leaders.
Well, it's something that I'm thinking a lot about now. We have a tremendous group of full-time staff here, and a few of them are some younger individuals, and I see myself in them. A few of them are just right out of college, and I remember very clearly what it was like to be in your first job right out of college, and the approach I'm taking with them, and time will tell whether it's the right approach, but the approach I'm taking is trying to help make sure that I'm a resource to them, but that I'm also pushing them to challenge themselves quite significantly. I mean, I've made it clear to them that if they're still in the same job 2 years from now, there's a problem, not just for them, but for the organization. And trying to help them discover the opportunities to grow in this organization, and that's tricky, and
sure.
Time will tell if we're getting it right or not. But I guess my perspective is that as I work with younger people, I want to view them as not only support and help for the organization, but I want to view them as people who have tremendous potential, who 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, who knows what positions they might be in. And I want to help cultivate that however I can.
So that's looking down one direction, and the way you sit, you also have to look up, and you have to manage up to a group of people who have authority over you, obviously, but are not, they're volunteers, really, board members. Tell us a little bit about how you handle that, if you have a different approach when you're managing up than you do when you're managing down, and how do you deal with that?
I think I'm still trying to figure it out, to be honest with you. We have a fabulous board. It's unique in that I was hired before the board was created. So I was hired actually by the Kansas Health Foundation, our funder. And then the board was created about 7 or 8 months later. So I had large influence on the selection of the board members. which is a very fascinating and interesting situation, as you might imagine. And so I think we're still figuring it all out. I know as a younger person, it's been hard for me to figure out exactly what the appropriate role for me is with the board. I mean, technically, they're my bosses. At the same time, none of them are experts on civic leadership development. They all have tremendous civic leadership experience. So it's a really fascinating situation. And I don't think it's just a generational thing, because we have a good variety on the board in terms of generations. But I think it's just trying to get a sense of what is the unique role of the board. And we've had fabulous conversations about that. And it's still a work in progress. You know, we're fortunate that, unlike a lot of nonprofits, we don't need this board to raise money for us. We don't need this board to, you know, stuff envelopes for us and do work. So they have a unique position. And, you know, my perspective has been that, you know, part of my role is to help push the board to discover what is their unique contribution to the Kansas Leadership Center. They obviously have the traditional governance role, the legal responsibility.
Sure.
But beyond that, what is their unique leverage within the organization? And it's a work in progress, but it's been fun because we were talking about it quite openly. So we're not just allowing it to figure itself out. We're being intentional about surfacing that question and talking about it as a group.
Yeah, I think people don't really appreciate how challenging the position of being a CEO of a nonprofit is, and you're really kind of caught in an interesting, oftentimes an interesting dilemma. Sounds like yours is unique in that you were instrumental in forming the board, and one of those pressures of fundraising is not one that seems to exist in your organization at this point, so that's
right.
Good for you.
Yeah, we're very lucky. It's a healthy burden again.
So that was Ed O'Malley. He's the CEO of the Kansas Leadership Center, which is a truly unique organization. I tell you what, if you're interested in developing leaders, I don't think you could find probably a more attractive job if you're up for a challenge. And you know, he has quite a unique challenge in front of him, but he also has the good fortune of not being in that doom loop we talked about earlier and being well-funded. So, Pam, what were your thoughts about what Ed had to say in the first half of our interview? We will have the second half next week.
Right. I really appreciated what he said about starting with a year's worth of listening. and there's such pressure to act. And many funders aren't patient funders, and he's lucky to have some patient money. But even when we don't, again, that the courage of a leader in saying what's ultimately most useful as opposed to what's most expedient, to say we're going to take some time and we're going to really listen and understand the challenges before we wade in with interventions.
Tremendously unique opportunity to really be in that position. There's very few nonprofit CEOs that don't have to worry about funding, and he's fortunate to be one of those with a $30 million commitment from the Kansas Health Foundation. And that gives you the latitude, really, to take that longer-term view, doesn't it? And I think that's what is just missing so often, and one of the issues that really, I think, is the genesis of your research report of the week this week was, so often nonprofit leaders are caught in this, looking at tactical short-term solutions, and Ed is fortunate to be running an organization that doesn't have that concern, and also helping other organizations in the community, and we'll get into more of that next week, through developing their leaders, oftentimes free, sometimes very economical.
Just to pick up on that point, and I know our listeners will get to hear Ed talk about that next week, I was impressed that how readily available they're making their information to everybody. And I know so many nonprofits hold on tightly to their intellectual property, and I can understand why, because that kind of revenue from selling the booklets and all that is so important to them. And yet, how fabulous that Kansas Leadership Center is making their materials broadly available. And one prime example that really encourage our listeners to go and pull down from the website is their facilitator field guide. And it is kind of a not even a white paper, but it's got practical exercises, etc. It was developed for the facilitators for their programs, but really it's useful for anybody who, even if they don't have the title facilitator, somebody who just runs a meeting or participates in meetings where you're trying to deal with tough issues. And it's a whole, leadership class basically in one PDF, and I just can't recommend it highly enough. It's a good accompaniment as well to people who've been following what Heifetz and Linsky have been doing with adaptive leadership as it takes it to the next level of practice, really drawing on the concepts that they introduce about adaptive challenges and managing the heat and making it possible for people to stay at the table while dealing with some really tough issues.
Yeah, I know Ed is definitely a big fan of the program at Harvard, and I know continues to work with Marty on things. And that was the first half of the interview, and the second half we'll get into a little bit more detail about what they do over there, and we hope you tune in for that next week. So, Pam, did you have any other closing comments, thoughts about leadership this week?
Just that there is so much information that is whizzing by on Twitter so fast about leadership. And on one hand, it is, it is great to see the thousands of flowers bloom. And it's also a little bit daunting for somebody who's just getting into it. So my encouragement is, if people are interested in getting on Twitter, go see the guide from a few weeks ago. Leader Talk has a wonderful Getting on Twitter guide. And follow a few folks. Obviously, I think Weekly Leader is great in pointing to those resources, but then look and see who are the folks who interact with Weekly Leader and start building for yourself a feed. And I've now got it to the point where, I love looking at Twitter because it's like there are curated links for me, that every day I look at and go, wow, thank you to these folks for finding great resources for me. So I encourage people to dive in and manage the overwhelm by starting with a small list and grow from there.
Yeah, definitely. And, we talked about this previously. I recommend that people use one of these third-party apps and set it up so you can search on terms that might be important to you and your industry. So I have leadership as a term that whenever anybody updates on leadership on Twitter, I have a stream that just follows that. And there's other terms that I follow as well, and it can be really useful if you use, I use Seismic Desktop, but there's TweetDeck, there's a number of them. And can be extremely useful. So not only do you get to see your own people that you're following, but you also get to see people that you might not have been connected to or know that are there, and but still talk about leadership. So, Twitter is definitely a tool that does, it's real time. So it gives you an opportunity to see some really interesting things. And not only that, it's two ways. You can engage in conversations when you see something that interests you. So hop aboard. Well, Pam, thanks. That was another good episode. And next week we'll have the second part of Ed O'Malley's interview. And I'm looking forward to talking to you then. We'd love for you to join us in the leadership conversation. We've given you lots of ways to do that. So head on over to weeklyleader.net and find the podcast post and let us know what you thought about what you heard today. And give us some ideas of what you'd like to hear in the future. We'd love to get your opinions. We also have a talented team of bloggers who are passionate about leadership, and they'd love to hear from you as well. So find one of their posts and engage in a leadership conversation with them. You can find us on Twitter, and Weekly Leader is at Weekly Leader. Pam is at PamFR, and I'm at Peter Mello, and that's PeterMello. All of our contributors are also on Twitter, and we will have their IDs in the show notes as well. We'd love for you to submit an audio comment, and it's pretty easy to do. Just record an MP3 file of 5 megs or less and attach it to an email. Send it to podcast@weeklyleader.net, and we'll find a way to integrate it into the show. If you use iTunes, we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review the podcast. We've got a bunch of ratings and reviews, and it helps just helps to get more listeners. So we'd really appreciate your contributions there. Each week, we use PodSafe Music from Music Alley, which used to be the PodSafe Music Network. And this week, as always, our intro is Transcends by Trance Blackmon. The music on either side of the Ed O'Malley interview was a song called Lead the Way by Common Ground. And finally, we're going to finish up with a relatively new song by Adrena Thorpe called Impossible Dream. We hope you enjoy them. So we know how valuable your time is, and we really appreciate you investing it with us. We look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Flawed I am and flawed I will remain. Broken since the day the package opened. Yearn with tattered wings to try to fly. Ache to find the strength to say goodbye to this impossible dream. Impossible dream promises everything, everything. And the sirens they sing, the sirens they sing. This impossible dream. Impossible dream. Can I keep each step upon this one? Run so fast that I can regain time. Gather in my arms the things I like. Overflowing, falling, I can take them back to this impossible dream. Impossible dream promises everything, everything. And the sirens they sing, the sirens they sing. This impossible dream. this impossible dream, impossible dream.